Welcome to ITE 1, Semester 2, Module 4. Today we're going to do troubleshooting, but first, a couple of quick administrative things. Actually, just one. Please send all worksheets to ite1@gmail.com. A couple people
have... dots.net.
Sorry. A couple of people have sent... Yes, right. A couple of people have sent them directly to instructors, and we are taking different portions of the course to grade. So if you could send it there, it will get to the appropriate instructors. I will forward the ones that I have got to you, Elise, this time, but please try to make a note of ite1@gots.net.
Okay, the second administrative thing that I want to mention today is, has anybody actually, and we're just curious to know, has anybody actually downloaded any of the lectures for this semester of ITE1? I have just updated and put the rest of the lectures up yesterday, but has anybody been downloading the MP3s and has anybody actually listened to them and the people enjoying them? Because if people are having trouble accessing those resources, we'd like to know.
I know that one of our students is.
Cool,
no
problem.
Can I be of assistance with that, Grace? Or have you guys got it covered?
With what?
Helping them access their MP3.
I think they found them.
He's okay. He's downloading them and liking them and doing his worksheets remotely.
Okay, well... Okay, and just, you mirrored the whole class notes tree. Keep in mind that the lectures go up each week, so if you want an MP3 copy of the lectures, or because of your interesting sleeping patterns, you fall asleep in the middle of one of our lectures, you might want to actually pull down the lecture and finish off the rest of it at high speed. I used to pull them down and do them at double speed. It went quicker that way. That was just me. If you can, if you can figure out roughly how to get an RSS feed going under Leopard Server, and we will be going to Snow Leopard soon, or give us some idea of the infrastructure we'd need to put in place, we would be happy to make that happen. We're transitioning to a new XServ. We're in the middle of doing that. We should be done by Friday. We are running standard Leopard 10.5.8, and we have PHP and MySQL enabled.
Yep, all you need to do is put up one file and know how to edit the XML file. I was actually thinking about proposing it the other week, and I thought, oh, will people go mad with downloading it and bandwidth issues and stuff?
Not an RSS feed, it's probably fairly small. Look, we
But the MP3s that downloads are the same MP3s that the people are manually downloading.
People are mirroring the whole server. There are piles of people who are just mirroring the whole server. I'm looking at locking out whole sections of the server to stop people from grabbing them, like the old CCNA1 notes, because they're not really relevant in 2009. Anyway, we digress. We'll talk about this after lecture.
Anyway, we can digress and talk about it later, But it's easy to do.
But yeah, thanks for that suggestion. We'd like an RSS feed, and if Christopher and Elise want to cooperate on that and make the RSS feed happen, we are happy chappies. Get me the file to upload, or tell me what file is going to be uploaded where, and I'll give somebody permission to do it. Done.
Cute.
That would be really sweet, yeah. Very much appreciated.
And we might, you'll notice that there's a Thursday chat on RSS feeds in the 2007 Thursday chats. We actually have a talk about RSS feeds, and Internet Explorer 8 is quite accessible for reading RSS feeds, as far as I know. After lecture, we might ask people what they use for reading RSS feeds, if they read them.
Internet Explorer, it's very, very good for that. Now, is my Autobox okay, everybody?
Yep, you're fine.
She does. She sounds absolutely beautiful. Off you go.
Jenny, I'm not hearing your audio on a intro. Okay, cool. Just wanted to make sure I didn't mute her or something so that she came through.
How is that?
Perfect. Okay, cool. All right, do we have any other administrative issues before we start?
Or general questions from anybody.
I had one, but it kind of left me. I'll let you know if it ever comes back.
Okay.
Just another point, people, is everybody doing their worksheets? We should be seeing worksheets from everybody. I think we just about are, but the worksheets are important. Your labs and your worksheets are worth 15% of your grade, just so you know.
Ah, yes. Speaking of worksheets, that's kind of where I was going to go with that. You know how they come up as PDF?
No, they don't.
They don't. No, they don't. We have dot copies on the server under worksheets in the ITE1 area. You can download those and go to your heart's content. That's actually on the QCAT site. They're all PDFs. They're not QCAT, Cisco.
You just grab them off the QCAT site, guys, because they're all Word docs, as Grace just said.
I'd really encourage people to really look at the QCAT site very carefully before you start pulling down the Cisco resources, because we have done a lot of the grunt work in converting them down into more easily accessible formats, and you'd be surprised. The QCAT site's actually a goldmine of useful information, or at least we like to think so. There's all sorts of things on there, so really get used to that site and learn how to navigate around it and stuff. And if anybody has any suggestions on how to make it easier to navigate, let us know, although we tend to like it pretty much the way it is, so we'd be interested to hear. People can email us some suggestions and stuff. We're not interested in making it flashy or Silverlight or any of those sorts of Web 2.0 technologies. We'd like to keep it simple, and we'd like to make sure you guys can get the information off it that you need.
I personally like it.
Oh, it's great. It's very easy and light and clean.
All right, off we go, I think.
Anything else from anybody? Okay, then we are going to start. Today we're doing Module 4, which is preventative maintenance and troubleshooting. You're going to be introduced to the troubleshooting process. This is very... Oh, I did. Is that better? There we go. This is very important. You're going to be using this troubleshooting process the rest of the course. So pay attention. We will be doing it again. But it's very important that you start to get familiar with it now, because you're going to be with this the rest of the course. And a lot of the rest of the course focuses on troubleshooting. So, first we're going to start with preventative maintenance. Preventative maintenance helps to reduce potential hardware or software problems. You need to develop a preventative maintenance plan based on the needs of the equipment, and the worksite and the customers that you're working on, or your own computer. So what kind of things do you think would be in a preventative maintenance plan?
Disk cleanup and defrag?
Yep.
Go ahead.
I was just going to tell a little story here, a very quick one. Have you ever seen those sort of people that don't ever do any preventative maintenance? Yeah, antivirus and spyware, that's good. Has anybody ever seen people who never do preventative maintenance on their car, and then they go on a long car trip, and about 20 miles out of home, the car goes and it dies, and then you wait 2 hours for the RAC or the NRMA or whatever it is that you call to get your car fixed.
AAA in America,
and then you curse and swear about how it took them 2 hours to get to you, and how if you just managed to check that oil and that water and the petrol and stuff before you left, you wouldn't have had this problem. Well, computers are a bit the same, so there you go. So yeah, disk defrag, disk cleanup, antivirus, spyware.
We've also got some hardware maintenance that you can do, and we will get back to that later. You will have a lab for this module, which I will write up today and send out to the list. It is not on the QCAT worksheet server. It is an extra lab. Because I think you guys should get something out of this chapter. And if you don't have something to do, and it's very easy to do, and it's very, very functional, and it's something that you can use forever and ever. It's something you can use forever. We're going to have you write up a preventative maintenance plan for your computers, because I think that's important, and it'll keep you on track for this chapter, and it won't just blow by, and you won't be like, what was that chapter on anyway? So that's going to be something I will write up for you guys, just and start working on it if you want to today before I write it up, or whatever you'd like. We'll go on to more about preventative maintenance in a little while. Make sure to document, which is what you're going to do, document the routine maintenance tasks that must be done to computer equipment and the frequency of that's pretty much going to be your assignment. Okay, go ahead. All right. He just made sure I ate it. Okay. Okay. This is a big one. For liability reasons, a technician either does a backup or has access to the backup of the customer's data before we start working on it. Make sure that the technician has the customer's permission to proceed in writing if there is no backup. Or even if there is, if you are afraid that data might be lost, do get that in writing. If they won't give it to you in writing, don't do the work, because you can be liable for data loss. Just make up a little waiver for yourself and bring it with you on each visit, and say the work I do may incur data loss, and I won't be held responsible if it does. And that's pretty much what you got to do, because you do not want to get into legal trouble because somebody's data is gone.
The other thing we used to do was we used to actually get the user in front of the computer, and we used to type in the command that we thought may potentially do some damage, and we'd have the command sitting there on the screen, and we'd go, right, this command could trash your whole computer. It's up to you whether or not you press the return key. If you press the return key, you take full responsibility for the command that will run. If you do not press the return key, then we do not run this command and your computer stays in its current state. Some people would press the return key, some people wouldn't press the return key, but at least the users were aware that they took full responsibility for pressing that final button. If they didn't understand what the command was going to do or what the sequence was going to do, then maybe they shouldn't be pressing the return key, or maybe they don't feel comfortable taking that risk with their data, and that's their decision to make.
Absolutely, that is a really good idea. I am supposed to remind you guys to always unplug the computer from the AC power source and properly ground yourself against unwanted static electricity before repairing a computer or any other electronic device. That's pretty much standard. It is a common situation that a technician might ask additional questions throughout the troubleshooting process. Remember not to ask repeating questions to the customer, or they will think that you are just not paying attention to them and get really annoyed.
One of the things that drives me batty, one of the things that really annoys me is when you get onto a help desk and they go through this script and you've provided them the information, and then they ask you three questions on the information that you've already provided, and that just really annoys me as an end user. So I try to listen to the user and make sure I take their information on board, and if it answers some of my future questions, I note that down so that I don't have to re-ask them a question again that they've already answered.
Absolutely. Just skip it if you've got the question. Go ahead.
I rang up two help desks yesterday, one for internet connectivity and the other one for my VoIP, and I must say I got two very different responses. One did exactly what Terry did. Listened to my... Well, I just said I'm already a technician, I'm having problems authenticating, so that answered probably about 20 questions she would have asked a novice user. The person at the VoIP organisation wasn't as bright and tried to go back to A1, and I said, no, we need to start at level 5 for me, because I can tell you where we're at. So there you go. It just makes a difference when they actually ask you, if they listen to what you say, because your chances are you've already answered some of their future questions, as Kerry said.
That is always very important.
Now, you think that's a little bit brutal, looking at it from the user's perspective. Christopher, that's an interesting comment. The fact is, though, I'd just like to point out at this point that when everything works, the technician is the absolute poster child angel. And when everything doesn't work, Satan's wrath comes down upon you, and you are responsible for every computer hiccup in the organization, and they will hunt you down and kill you, because you are the tech guy, and you are responsible for all of the problems, and they will vent their spleens on you if you work for somebody. And it's not fair and it's not right, but people get really nasty when their computers don't work, especially when they're unable to work and when they're unproductive, and the tech people get it, which is why we always go down to the pub and have lots of beer. No, seriously, which is why we always work professionally with the customers and trying to keep them as happy as we can, and we don our flame-proof underwear, because users can be quite angry people.
I really read my audience too. Some of the customers, you might just want to give them the piece of paper and have them sign it. Other customers, you might want to use the more literal, if you press the enter key, your computer might not work and your data might be lost. It just really depends. Oh yeah, definitely. Treat them nice even if they're stupid. Very, very important.
Just a point on that. I'm not stupid is one of those statements that as soon as you make it, you're going to do something that is really stupid. It's sort of one of those self-fulfilling prophecies. I remember I was walking around the house one day and I said, I never walk into walls. And Bianca said, oh, really? And I said, no, into the wall I went. And that was pretty funny. But the point is that your definition of stupid might not be somebody else's definition of stupid. And we have to be as patient with people as we can because we're all stupid ones. As far, or at least we didn't know what we know now. So whilst, say for example, we must all try to maintain patience with people, especially as teachers and instructors, but especially as people who are working in the technical industry, because not everybody knows what you know. It'd save a lot of time if they did, but they don't. So try and be as patient and tolerant of people's limitations as you can, because not everybody is at the same level. And if they are really silly and they don't want to learn, then charge them more. Sometimes that can help. That sounds really awful, but if it really is taking up a lot of your time, charge them for your time. And they can make a decision as to whether they want to pay the extra money for you to spend the extra time with them after you've given them a fair go, of course.
Now, we don't usually want to call people stupid. Less technically skilled people is probably better, because they might be really great at something else that you're not so great at. You don't know. And we'll be talking about those less technically skilled people in a little bit.
It's getting back to what Carrie said, it's amazing how quickly people learn if they see the value of it. And if you are going to charge them, they get to see the value of your knowledge, and they tend to absorb it a bit better if you let them know that.
Oh, yeah. The best things in life are not always free. They'll appreciate it more and really, really get a lot out of the training if you have them pay.
We actually found that when we offered a free course, people didn't really take us seriously, which is why, I mean, there are funding reasons, but that's why we all, because you basically buy the hardware that allows us to keep our course running. That's why there's a nominal fee for this course, because it does make people take it a little bit more serious than a freebie, because if you provide something for free, people seem to think that it has no value, and there were honestly people who used to believe that because Linux was free, it was worthless, and the two are not the same thing, but we return to our previously scheduled programming.
Okay. Back to our... you may not realize that there are more than one solution to a problem. Such as, network problems have various solutions to them. You could reset the router, or you could release and renew the IP address to get your network connectivity up. Two solutions. Now, resetting the router is the more difficult solution, so maybe we would try to reset the IP first. Make sure to implement the solutions from the easiest and fastest and less risk of losing data or hurting a computer part to the most...
Yeah, I agree.
No, of course. But if we're just talking about once you've gathered the data, you have two solutions to a problem. You want to try the easiest one first.
One of the things that I have seen... Go on, Alice.
One of the things that help desk people will often get you to do is try the easiest things first, like if you're having problems connecting to your internet. They might say, unplug it, plug it back in. That's right. Well, yesterday... Okay, for the person who's coming up on the chat, yep, that's fine. I had a connectivity that problem with my ISP yesterday. It definitely wasn't my fault because it was a problem with TPG. However, having said that, at least I was able to prove that by doing the simple things first, by power cycling my ADSL modem, etc. Then I rang up the help desk and I said, look, I'm already a technician. I've done the simple things first. I've power cycled my modem, so I don't have to bother the help desk person to say, well, okay, power cycle your modem, because I'd already done all that. And I said, I'm just not authenticating. So I went through the easy steps first in the hope that the easy steps would have fixed my problem. As it turned out, it was a little bit more serious, but all the problems I've since resolved.
Yeah, I agree. I always try the quick things first. Just, you know, if I know it's a network problem, I want to try the stuff on my end so I don't waste somebody else's time.
Yeah, I think the point that's trying exactly to be made, right, though, is I think the point that Chris is trying to make, which is the point I was making earlier this morning, don't just try releasing and renewing your IP address because you think it's going to be like sacrificial goat's blood if you don't understand the underlying problem. I see a lot of technicians go through, let's just try this, let's just try that, let's just try this third thing, when in fact none of the three things they're about to try has anything to do with the problem. And a lot of people mess around with computers and fix them by pure luck, just because one of the things they happened to try worked, rather than taking a focused approach to the problem solving. So my advice to you is try and know what you are doing and understand the process that you're going through and understand the root cause if you can, so that you are more efficient at fixing these problems, because you as the technician is supposed to know stuff.
Right, but if you know that you have a network problem and you figured that out because you've checked and a bunch of your Internet Explorer is not working, your email's down, your Skype is not working, you know you're not connected to the Internet. So you know what the cause of the problem is. It's a network problem. Now we got to try and figure out what to do about it.
Yeah, but because Chris is an experienced technician, he's actually going to look at the diagnostic stuff and look... yeah, that's right. He knows what to look at after that, though. A lot of us will just turn off and turn on the router and hope that it works. Now, that's an easy thing to do, but in fact, you can actually go into the interfaces of things and actually look at what the cause is, because if the problem is a reoccurrent one, you'll want to know how to fix it again in future. But to be honest with you, Christopher, that comes with experience. Not everybody is at that point yet. Not everybody understands that you can actually dig down into these things and actually look at the underlying causes. This is ITE 1, not ITE 2, so people have to learn to become proficient at that. They're not at that level yet. Some of you are, but not all of you are, and that's something that comes with experience and getting your teeth cut on something. I do know a lot of people who will tend to release and renew their IP address because they think it's going to do something. But, as I said, it may pay to already check whether you do have an IP address before you bother releasing and renewing it. Unfortunately, Microsoft has taught us that the best way to fix a computer is to reboot it. Reboot it. Reinstall it. Uninstall and reinstall. That doesn't work on everything, but sadly it does work on a lot of things.
Can I just ask one?
Yeah.
What were you going to say, Mark? Sorry?
As you guys are talking here, I'm thinking about every time I go to my Yahoo through Internet Explorer, on my Dell, it doesn't, like it has a, when you go to the email, it's got a drop down thing and it'll show you a little preliminary list of what your emails are. It doesn't happen with that. Like, it'll drop down fine, no problem. On my HP, it has a habit of dropping down and then closing back up. Before I log in, and even after I've logged in from the main page. What would that be, do you think?
That's an issue for Yahoo's technical support. I'm sorry, Mark. We don't cover that here. That is seriously an issue for Yahoo technical support, or for somebody that you are paying to do consultant services for you. I really have to stress this, and I'm really sorry to put this out there, but whilst we will help as much as possible, we are not here to fix your computer unless it directly deals with coursework, and in this case it kind of does, but we're also not here to fix your computer on lecture, so please set a time if you wish to ask somebody a question and do that outside of lecture, because we do have material to get through. I'm sorry to be heavy-handed here, but we really have to do this, otherwise we'll spend the 2 hours solving people's niggly little computer problems. Don't worry, you're not the first and you won't be the last.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. It is important to document work orders and journal. Technicians should document everything they try, even if it fails, because the next time you have that problem, you'll be able to look back at that documentation and see what didn't work. The documentation that you create will become a useful resource for you and other technicians in the future.
And you think you'll remember something? But believe me, you don't. I was working on a computer last night, and I had forgotten that I did not buy the video integrated with the motherboard, and I was looking for video drivers all over the EVGA disk, and then I remembered what I had done, and okay, it's not going to be on EVGA's site, it's going to be elsewhere, duh.
Yeah, once you've solved one computer problem, you might remember your very first computer problem, your second one, your third one. But eventually it all starts to blur sometimes, and it's great to have that documentation say, oh, here it is. That's perfect. I've got it. And you have it, and you can just quickly look it up and quickly implement the solution and save yourself tons of time and make your customer really happy because, wow, that was so fast. And you'll get called back again, possibly.
We had an instance of that the other day. Grace installed Office 2007 onto her MSI Wind, and the spell check in Outlook Express defaulted to the French dictionary. Yes, it's a known problem. The irony was I got a message from a friend of mine a year and a half ago that documented the solutions to that problem, and I was able to forward her that email, and she now has the tools to be able to get her Outlook Express out of the French language into something that is a little more useful, because the spell checker with Office 2007 is newer than the one in Outlook Express, and it overrides it and it defaults to French. So there you go, the funny problems you come up with, and if I hadn't had that documentation, I wouldn't have known how to fix it.
It was really helpful for him to have that email. I was quite happy to be able to fix it very quickly. Okay, we are going to have a discussion about preventative maintenance now. Preventative maintenance, as I said, helps minimize failures of computers. This means the less troubleshooting, you have to do less troubleshooting when things fail, and this means you will save time and money for a company. It's better to have scheduled downtime to fix things than have random unscheduled downtime when everybody is trying to work. At least you know when the downtime is going to happen and approximately how long it'll be if all goes well. And this does save money because it's better to have the downtime, you know, early in the morning when no one's there or when everybody's at lunch, rather than at 4:30 when everybody's trying to beat those deadlines. That costs a lot of money and brings a lot of stress.
I was just going to say, from somebody who's been here and done this, plan your downtime. Make sure you know exactly what you're going to do in the downtime and that you have it pre-planned so that you know exactly what's going to happen. Back in 1997, I rebuilt a regional ISP, as you do. I'm on a Saturday, you know, I had nothing better to do. And the bloke who ran the office, he sort of said, look, if you can fix this ISP, you know, get him whatever he wants, cartons of beer, whatever. Turned out all I wanted was some Hungry Jacks, but, you know, the joys of being young. The moral of the story was he came back to us on the Monday morning and said, did you guys do any work over the weekend? And I said, yeah, we've been working all weekend. And he said, well, you said there'd be some downtime. I said, there was. He said, no, there wasn't. I said, yeah, there was 25 minutes on the Saturday afternoon between 4 and 4:25. He goes, yeah, I do remember having trouble connecting, but I walked away and connected half an hour and it worked again. I said, yep, that's what planned downtime will do for you. You're up and running, and we were down for 25 minutes. And they got me back for quite a number of jobs in future because the forward planning saved them time and kept their customers happy, and that kept them in business. We have a computer person that we know, we won't be any more specific than that, that likes to down everything at 3:30 in the afternoon. Thanks, mate.
Yeah, that's about one of the worst times you could do it. Do it for lunch if you must. So, preventative maintenance is a schedule of planned maintenance actions aimed at the prevention of breakdowns and failures. The primary goal of preventative maintenance is to prevent the failure of equipment before it actually occurs. See Carrie's car story. It is designed to preserve and enhance equipment reliability by replacing worn components before they actually fail, or making sure your disk space is all cleaned up before it runs out. Preventative maintenance activities include equipment checks, partial or complete overhauls at specified periods, oil changes, lubrications, and so on. In addition, workers can record equipment deterioration so they know to replace or repair worn parts before they cause system failure. Recent technical advances in tools for inspection and diagnosis have enabled even more accurate and effective equipment maintenance.
Just a really good example of that. Has anybody heard of the technology called SMART, Self-Monitoring Analysis and Reporting Technology? Yeah, that's a good one, Robert.
Absolutely.
Anyone heard about SMART?
Yep.
Sorry, have not.
Yeah, it's actually part... they have turned it on in 7, I think you're right. But as a matter of fact, SMART is actually a feature that is in most BIOSes. So if you can either be patient with a KNFB reader or get a Cytolink to help you reconfigure your BIOS, if you enable SMART, it will often warn you of an impending drive failure when you boot the machine up. So if it says... impending disk failure, yeah, that works too. You can actually go out and buy a new hard disk, back all the data up off your old one and swap the old drive out and put the new disk in, and that's the idea. SMART is supposed to tell you about hard disk failing before it actually dies completely. And I can tell you from experience that that has saved my bacon, because I had it on one of my RAID arrays and it warned me of an impending drive failure. I swapped out the drive, resynced the array, and Bob's your uncle, Flo's your aunt, we're up and running again, and I had no data downtime.
Does Windows XP support that?
Yes, you can use that thing we used to... it does. The utility that I found that was accessible for doing that was... I'm just trying to remember what it was called. Will has it. I just can't remember the name. It was a free smart monitoring tool for XP. I'll try and get the name for you.
But you... Sure, you turn it on in BIOS and then you run that utility. Oh, it might be handy to get.
Well, you turn it on in BIOS and the BIOS will tell you at boot up whether there's an impending problem. Yeah, HDTune has smart support, that is correct. And there is actually one that sits in the system tray that monitors things, but I just can't remember what it's called and I'm in the middle of talking, so I can't look on my server and find out. So I'll go and look on my server in a minute and I'll tell everybody what it was called. But it actually pops up little alerts that say drive temperature has changed, this has changed, that's changed. But yeah, HDTune supports it, and I think so does MDM, the motherboard diagnostic manager or whatever it is, that thing that shows you all the temperatures and stuff. A lot of the system boards come with tools that do smart as well, and it will tell you when your hard drives are on the way out about 80 to 90% of the time, so it's worth knowing about.
Does it need to be turned on in BIOS for these tools to work, or can they, if it's turned off in BIOS, will these tools under Windows still function?
Sometimes. It's best to turn it on in BIOS so that it's enabled from the get-go.
I was going to say, it's probably safer. Yeah.
Yep.
Safer to switch
then
on.
Then it will
BIOS,
always probably work.
Well, the operating yes, you can, but I don't know whether it sticks over a hard reset. We'd have to look into that. I think you can actually turn it on, and in fact there are SmartMon tools on the GRML Live CD, and there are actually, and we have digressed a bit here, but there are actually tools in GRML to allow you to run extended self-tests on a hard disk, and they'll also allow you to dump the smart attributes with smart CTL. Unfortunately, we don't cover that directly in the course, but it is possible to actually interrogate your hard drive and find out what health it is with a GRML Live CD. So as we seem to say every week, if you haven't already got yourself a copy of GRML and you haven't given it a shot, pretty soon would be a good time to go and grab yourself one.
That's updated just about every day, I think, too, so the copy I've got here is probably quite old.
The stable releases are the safest, but you can actually get the daily builds if you want to live on the bleeding edge. There'll be some of us here who do live on the bleeding edge and we'll have the daily build, and there'll be other one of us who stick to running the actual releases. It just depends on how game you feel and whether you mind your software crashing once in a blue moon.
We might get a stable release.
The ideal preventative maintenance program would prevent all equipment failures before it occurs. I don't know if that's quite possible. Sorry about that.
What's actually orange?
The blue moon.
Oh, okay. I thought it was just the moon being sad. Mr. Squiggle had a bad day. Oh, you guys don't know who Mr. Squiggle is. It's all right. You can Wikipedia Mr. Squiggle.
Say that. They wouldn't know that, man.
I think you'd say that 80 to 90% of problems can be avoided by preventative maintenance.
But not all problems can be you're going to have some emergencies sometimes. Very rarely. You're going to have much, much, much less of emergency downtime. 90-95% of it, I'd say. But yeah, you can't prevent everything, so don't feel bad if accidents and emergencies do crop up from time to time. It will happen, and it does happen. And just get it fixed as best you can. But it does happen. There are lots of misconceptions about preventative maintenance. One of them is that it is unduly costly. People think that it would cost more to regularly scheduled downtime for maintenance than it would to wait and fix the problem later. But that's not quite true. You can have your downtime at the most when the network is the least used, and it can be quick and painless, and you won't have to fix it later. Unscheduled downtime is much more costly than just having a little bit of scheduled downtime every once in a while to, say, run your Windows updates or update your server kernels or whatever you've got to do than to have a problem. It may be true that you don't want to fix certain components, such as a very inexpensive home printer. You might just throw it away and get a new one when it wears out. But for most components, you do want to try to fix them, and you do want to try and repair them, because it'll be much less expensive to repair them than to replace them.
Any comments while Grace is scrolling?
Yeah, unless you've got buttloads of cash, which a lot of us don't.
Look, I think the reality there is the more you can learn to fix, the better off you'll be. But the fact is, to be honest with you, there is a line between where you have enough money to run and service a computer and you don't. And some people don't have enough money to run and service their computers. And whilst we would like everybody in the world to have a computer, if you can't afford to have a computer, you don't have one. And that's the sad reality of it, especially in the adaptive technology arena, given the prices on software and stuff, not everybody can afford to have a computer. There are always ways and means around this, but you do need a certain amount of operating capital to keep a computer running, as you need a certain amount of operating capital to keep a car running. Cars don't run without petrol. Computers don't run without power and spare parts. That's just the way it is.
No.
People don't run without food.
Absolutely, Jenny. So, just to review some of the long-term benefits of preventative maintenance include improved system reliability, decreased cost of replacement decreased system downtime, better spare inventory management, and the long-term effects and cost comparisons usually favor preventative maintenance over performing maintenance actions only when necessary. So we're going to talk about types of preventative maintenance. Let's talk about hardware maintenance. What sort of things would we do to maintain our hardware?
Cleaning.
Absolutely. And if you do not know how to clean your computer, refer to Chapter 2. Absolutely.
Actually, there's some research that actually shows, just to throw a spanner in the works here, that defragmenting your hard drive too much can actually put extra wear and tear on your drive, and that the modern file systems are designed to avoid fragmentation. So perhaps defragmenting once a week or once every 2 weeks is probably sufficient. Otherwise, you will actually... or once a month, yeah. Otherwise, you'll actually...
Yeah, I do mine about once a month, once every 2 months.
Well, it depends on how many video files and stuff you're copying around and how much music you drop on and off the drive as to how fragmented it gets. There are utilities that will tell you about what level of fragmentation you've got. Defragler, which is a free utility from www.defragler.com, will do it. But yeah, there is actually evidence that says that if you defrag your drive every day, you're actually putting a lot of wear and tear on the drive that doesn't need to be there. Whereas with things like...
I don't know why you would either.
Well, it goes really, really fast. If you're doing audio editing and stuff, defragmentation of a drive is critical because it can cut the time you need to save and load your audio samples in half. especially with video editing. If you imagine a file is stuck into, say, 50 fragments, and each fragment is going to take 4 milliseconds to access, that's an extra 50 by 4 milliseconds that's going to be used up, and across your workday, having the drive go crunch, crunch, crunch can actually cost you a lot of time. So doing a defrag run before you start doing some heavy, large file editing can help. But yeah, so it's depends on whether you live in WA and your computing equipment comes from 1995. I mean, the other thing people have got to realise is that in a place like WA where money isn't tight, a bit like at Mark's place or whoever else's place we're talking about, people don't have the money to upgrade computers, so there are seriously people out here who are still running JAWS 3.3 with Windows 95.
I don't know. I think doing it every day is a little much. I do mine about every month, every 2 months, depending on when it needs it or not.
I thought they usually do it unless it gets to be about 10%. I mean, unless you are doing like audio or video editing, until it gets to, you know, above 10%, that it's really not necessary to defrag.
Absolutely. That's kind of how I feel about it.
I think it depends on what your machine's doing. Fair enough. Yeah, no, the old stuff still works quite well. What I tend to do is I listen to the drive, and if I hear it making a lot of thrashing noise, I will tend to do a defragment, because what you'll find is that System Restore will scribble stuff all over your drive as it goes. And in fact, some people I know actually just perform regular backups and shut off System Restore. I'm not quite that brave. But you can actually run a defrag. I tend to run them once a week, once every 2 weeks, because it does make an incredible difference to the speed of the computer. Also, I tend to fire off an XFS FSR, a file system reorganization, on the network servers every couple of weeks, because that keeps things shipshape too. So it just depends on what you feel and how important you feel that it is as to how often you run it. So listening to your equipment and stuff and listening to how much trouble it seems to be having can often help. So it's personal preference. Yes, JK Defrag is one of the utilities I certainly recommend, and there's a link to it from www.thefreecountry.com, or you can Google for JK Defrag. Also have a look at Defragler, which is the utility written by the Piriform, who are the same people who do CCleaner, which is another utility you should probably look at, along with Recover, R-E-C-U-V-A, which is the third utility they write.
Oh,
yes,
that's
Dust,
the registry backup one, isn't it?
No, Recover gets your deleted files back off NTFS a lot of the time.
Oh, yeah.
CClean is the one that can do some registry optimizations, but it also cleans up temp files and stuff. Be aware, though, that CCleaner can actually trash all of your cookies, and if you've got it remembering usernames and passwords because you can't be bothered to, that can upset you quite a bit when all of your usernames and passwords to all your sites have been wiped out of the cookies.
Yeah.
That's why it's a good idea to always write down your passwords somewhere and keep them very safe and very secret, because you never know when Internet Explorer or whatever your web... Oh, yeah,
KeePass password safe. www.keypass.info.
There it goes again, and it's one of the best pieces of software I think Kerry's put me on to for a long time. I just cannot live. 6 months ago, I didn't know what it was, and I can't live without it now.
What was the URL?
All resources file.
www.keypass.info, I think. KeyPass.info.
And you can run it from a thumb drive, so if you need to take your program and its associated database around with you to use on your laptop when you're not in the office, that is really cool. Well, you can copy it from your system to your laptop, which is what I do, just to replicate it every now and again.
This is where it's good when you read and write Braille, because most of the people around you can't read or write it.
Yep, all my passwords are written on my Braille device somewhere. No, Jenny, you can't use it now. But, yeah, they're somewhere. They're hidden. It's great.
That's a good way of doing it. But with KeyPass, you have one main password you have to remember, and as long as you can remember your master password, you've got access to everything. You can forget the rest.
Also with KeyPass, it actually has plugins for web browsers where if it actually sees the sites that it needs the passwords for, it can automatically pull them out of the KeyPass database and feed them into the websites for you automatically, so that star, 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 star field makes you happy because it's already pre-filled. Just a point on registry cleaners. Some of them are really good, and some of them are really bad. You did do a backup before you ran that registry cleaner, didn't you? Good.
Always back up the registry before you mess with it.
Back up your computer, even.
Okay.
You know, I've been doing this for about 20 years now, and editing the registry still makes me sick at my stomach.
I don't love to do it.
No, I totally agree. Totally agree.
It's a necessary evil, though.
I'm just especially saying, don't enter into it lightly.
Oh, absolutely not. Especially when Freedom Scientific decides to install some... especially when Freedom Scientific decides that they're going to ship a dodgy Visual C++ runtime with one of their flagship products, and then you actually have to go through with Clap Crap Cleaner and jam it out of the database and then reinstall the proper updated Visual C++ runtime so you can actually get AVG and a whole stack of other utilities working again. The fun just goes on and on. You do need special software to back up the entire computer. That would almost be a lecture in itself, how to back up.
Yeah.
There are ways you can back up 90% of it with just Windows Explorer. Yeah, sorry, you were going to say, Jen?
Is there a lecture on the QCAT website about backing up? Have you done one?
Ooh, we kind of have and we kind of haven't. It's one of those sort of really tricky things that we all tell you that you should do it, and when it actually comes down to it, it's actually quite complex because Windows locks files while it's running and stuff. I use a program called Zip Backup, which I love a lot, www.zipbackup.com, and there's a 30-day trial. It's really cool. It backs up into standard zip files, which means you can pull it out on anything, whether it's a Windows, a PC, or a Mac. And there's a little bit of JAWS cursoring necessary to select and unselect files, or mouse cursoring if you're using something else, but it tends to work very well. And then the other thing I use for backing up files and stuff, especially to network locations, is a freebie from Microsoft called RoboCopy. And it will actually keep two file trees in sync by only copying the differences. RoboCopy, one of those little-known utilities that comes in the Windows Server 2003 Resource Kit tools, of all things, that nobody really knows about, and it's an absolute goldmine of power.
I also use Handy Backup, and it's very accessible.
Yeah, we saw that message on the list the other day. That's good. I think we might start assembling this HTML resource at some point, and once we start to see bits of it assembled, I'll push the file up to somewhere where everybody can get it, we will... you can send your suggestions for things that should be in this HTML file to ite1@gots.net, and somebody will make that happen, and we'll have all sorts of links to all sorts of cool things.
I think that's a great idea. I think that would just be amazing.
And then we'll announce it on Top 10 Tidbits or something and get ourselves famous.
Yeah, that's an even better idea. Friends and Companion, we could put it all over.
We can all tweet about it, put it on Facebook and make it search engine friendly so everybody gets to look at it, the website. We'll have so many hits on QCAT. Might get corporate people taking notice of us.
Let's not miss the opportunity to ask for a donation, of course.
Absolutely.
If you found this information useful and your conscience is going to likely haunt you for the rest of your life if you don't, please donate lots of money to us.
We want it.
There's a PayPal link at the bottom of this website.
Exactly.
Right at the top, actually, right before the list.
And don't forget to donate to Twitter.
Why not set up a website?
Well, we have a website. We'll just put it on the QCAT website, and then we can also do an aliased virtual domain that would point to our particular list if we wanted to. We're just going to keep it fairly simple, though, because one of the things I find about things like a lot of wikis and stuff is they're a great idea in principle, but actually navigating them becomes more and more complex as they grow topsy-turvy and all over the place.
Yeah, just this big tree of stuff. Okay. I'll just quickly finish the hardware maintenance section here. Check the condition of cables, components, and peripherals. Just reach back and make sure to touch the back of your computer. Make sure those keyboard cables don't wobble. Make sure those network connections are secure. Make sure your cards are properly in place. Keep components clean to reduce overheating. Make sure there's no dust in your fan vents. Clean your keyboards. Clean the mouse if you use it. All that good stuff that we
covered. How about you clean the mouse even if you don't use it so that the person who does need to use it can use it?
Well, if you have one.
We have seven.
Well, I vote that you take the mouse out and shove it in the drawer.
Yep, that's my vote too.
Yeah, but put it in a Ziploc plastic bag so it doesn't fill up with dust.
Okay, well, we'll do that. Repair or replace worn components. Go ahead.
That was Marcus.
I was just going to say, and don't put it through a vacuum sealer either, like I asked earlier the other day.
Yes, he was actually asking whether it would be safe to store computer components in vacuum seal bags, and I was saying that if they Ziploc bags are not anti-static, that was my point.
Absolutely.
However, if the component does not have exposed things on it, so say, for example, it's a modem or something, it'd be safe to store one of those in a Ziploc bag, and I store a lot of my cables in Ziploc bags, but if you've got, like, an adapter card or something, no, Ziploc bags are not cool. Also, given the fact that the little pointy bits or the pals on the bottom of the circuit board are probably going to poke holes in your Ziploc bag.
Huh?
You guys missed out on that one.
I have another comment to make later. Just remind me.
You could share.
Well, fill us in.
Jenny was just saying that if I come at Grace with a Ziploc bag, I might want to store her somewhere.
Oh, I'm not worth a Ziploc bag.
Oh, yeah. That's good.
Okie dokies.
Repair or replace any worn components. I can make comments about that too, but won't. So if your modem is starting not to work, maybe checking and seeing what might be wrong with it, or going out and getting a new one before it completely breaks and you're without internet access is a good idea.
I actually have 3 spare ADSL modems. Count them. 1, 2, 3. I sort of have this thing where I have one to break, one as a spare, and one to use for development purposes. And it does cost me a lot more money, but you'd be surprised as to how often 2 people turn up at my place and go, you don't happen to have a watchamajig, and I sell it off at increased profit because they didn't have one and I did, and then I go and buy 2 more.
Yep, I think everybody has. All right, on to software updates. Mark, did you have something to say?
I was going to, but I can save it till after lecture.
Okay,
cool. Install security updates. I have a story. I have a client who is afraid to update their Windows because they did once, and it hosed their computer, and they lost their hotkeys. Yeah, but you really do want to make sure to update your computer. There are security patches that Microsoft sends out at least every month. And if you don't have them, you are leaving your computer open. Would you ride in a car without a seatbelt or go riding a motorcycle at 60 miles an hour without a bike helmet? Because that's basically what you're doing when you do not update your Windows update. Yeah, you might have a problem with your computer getting a little bit messed up sometimes. But if there's a Windows Secrets newsletter which tells you which updates are important and which ones are not if you pay for it. And it's very inexpensive to get. There's a free version that will tell you some of that. But if you pay for it, you'll get a lot more information.
2 things. The updates are actually every Tuesday. There is an update cycle and it is called Update Tuesday.
It's the second Tuesday of the month in America.
Yep, and they also have out-of-cycle updates that come out that are really, really important. Another reason why people don't want to run Windows Update, and this is sometimes a valid reason for some people, and we wouldn't condone this sort of behaviour, is some people are running pirated, non-genuine copies of Windows, and if you run Windows Update, you will be tripped out by the Windows Genuine Advantage notifications, and that can render your computer eventually inoperable.
Well, I'll tell you what, I had Windows Update mess me up seriously one time. I had to do a .NET 2.0 repair and everything.
Oh,
I saw the process for that. It was wicked. It was like, edit the registry and then copy these six DLLs in here and then edit this ini file and just like, excuse me? No, in all seriousness, people, Windows up, Windows Secrets, you donate what you think the the magazine is worth, so $10 or $20 US a year. It is the best $10 or $20 US a year you will ever spend, seriously. They tell you which patches are hot and which patches are not, and you can then choose to install the updates that work and the ones that don't work. If you have your Windows update set to automatically install all critical security updates, you are playing Russian roulette with your data.
Don't do it. Have it notify you when to download the update so you know what you're doing. But do it, you guys. Don't be afraid of it too much. It really shouldn't hose your computer if you know what you're doing. And it's very important to download those security updates because you are leaving yourself open to attacks. And by the way, once those security updates are out there, all the hackers know what they are. They know those bugs, and they can get you. So do.
There are actually some security updates that have hosed my computer, and I can actually remember a specific one that killed my Realtek sound manager, which left me with no speech and no jaws. Hurrah!
I had one that screwed up my Outlook Express once.
Yeah, so I'd really suggest that you do read Windows Secrets before you apply the updates, unless, of course, for some reason you can't afford Windows Update, and then I would suggest that you have really good backups. But I think... I disagree with Grace here. They should be safe, but quite often they're not. And in fact, I've actually seen cases where 3,000 or 4,000 corporate computers went down because Microsoft botched a security update. And then they didn't sort of tell anybody about the hot fix. They kept it quiet. So why MMV? Accidents do happen. It should be safe, but it not always is. So just be aware. Make sure you've got your data and your restore points and your backups.
I'm just making the point that sometimes... It can be a much better idea to do it and than to just say, oh no, I'm afraid of all Windows updates because one time it hosed me, because then you're just leaving yourself open. That's the only point I'm trying to make with this.
Yeah, exactly.
You may not, and you probably will be okay, but if there's a problem, at least know when you've done it so you can try and reverse it. But it is important to keep your computer updated.
The other thing that's really bad that I'll mention here too is keep your antivirus, anti-spyware and stuff software up to date. A virus or anti-spyware program with outdated definitions is often a false sense of security and can be more... can lull you into a false sense of security. So make sure you keep those things updated, because otherwise you'll think you're protected and you're not.
Another thing to be aware of, if you get an email from a company like your antivirus or Winamp or spyware saying that there's a new update, download it now by clicking on this link, maybe you shouldn't. Maybe you should go to the website and actually go to the download page and download it from there, if there is one, because that's called phishing sometimes, and they can be fake, and they could be a virus themselves. So just be aware of that and be careful.
Also, Microsoft is not going to give you $1 million. They're not going to give you a trip to Disneyland. And Mr. Abu Hadi from South Africa, who was apparently the bloke that was looking after some guy's wealth that just got shot in 1996, is not going to give you $20,000 for managing his millions. A little bit of common sense goes a long way, people. Use it across your computing environment and you will be a happier computer user.
If it's too good to be true, maybe it is.
I've gotten those emails before. They go right in the trash.
Absolutely. I just laugh at them, and then they go in the trash.
Some of them can actually look quite legitimate, though, so you do have to be careful. Some of them are getting quite clever. We actually got one that said, it was from admin@gots.net, and it said mail server outage, and my wife read it. And had to actually read it twice to make sure that it wasn't something I had inadvertently sent out, and it was very cleverly crafted. I had a look at it, and it looked pretty legitimate. But often you can pick a couple of spelling errors, you can pick invalid URLs, and often bad grammar. The other thing is those schemes, which are called 415 schemes, look them up on snopes.com, snopes.com. That's the one that does all of the... all of the debunking of all the urban myths. There have actually been people killed in Nigeria going to get their millions, and people have basically waited for them at the airport and shot them and taken all their money.
Absolutely. Don't do it.
I actually have gotten a whole bunch of emails in one of my email accounts from they claim to be PayPal, but you look at the address, it's something like high five at whatever, you know, it's like, no.
I think you can always.
Yeah, I was just about to say, you can just call PayPal and ask them whether they sent you that message.
What you do is you can log into your account and see, it'll tell you if it's suspended. It's right up there in big old print that you're suspended. Otherwise, you're fine. And once you see that, you just forward that email to spoof@paypal.com and you've done your good deed for the day.
I actually got one with valid headers, and I actually rang PayPal up about it and asked them, and they said, yeah, that wasn't one they were actually aware of, and it actually looked quite legitimate. It didn't have any links to click on. It didn't have any of the usual things that said click on this link, but it did have the correct PayPal ID, and it did have all of the correct headers. So if you really are unsure, seriously, give them a ring and check. If you've gone in and logged into your account, as Grace has suggested you do, and you're still unsure, there are numbers in Australia that are 1-800 numbers or whatever. Give them a call and ask them. They'll either tell you yes or no, and it won't cost you any money, and it might just put your mind at rest. And you'll know one way or the other.
In America, the number is 1-800-4-PAYPAL, 729-725.
Thing that happened to me about 4 years ago, I guess, is that I own a list for blind musicians, and we had just had a virus scare on list where there were some people that actually were infected and were transmitting it over the list, and I got that situated, and then a very respected adaptive technology person who will remain nameless sent around an email that she'd gotten from somewhere stating that this one file was a virus and needed to be deleted. There was only one problem. It was Windows 98 version of long file name handler. Yeah.
I remember that one, actually. Yeah, I remember that one. You delete lfn.whatever out of C Windows system or whatever. Yeah. And it looked very genuine, except it wasn't. Got to be careful. If somebody tells you to do something in an email, verify that it is actually something you need to do before you actually go do it.
It really looked very genuine. It really did.
Sometimes it's hard to tell.
A little
I think better to be safe than sorry is...
Go ahead.
Leon?
Yeah, sorry, Jackie, I jumped over the top of you, but a little saying that I've made up is, if it's doubtful, it's dangerous.
A little bit of knowledge can be dangerous, but a fair bit of knowledge is fairly good. But yeah, if it's doubtful, it can be dangerous. And it's up to you to either eliminate the doubt so that it stops becoming dangerous, or don't undertake whatever it is. Yeah, that's another one that I've seen. A lot of people have well-meaning intentions, and they send out these messages because they do look legitimate, and they do get people into a lot of trouble. I actually saw a friend of mine has a thing at the bottom of his emails, and it says, if an email says to forward this to all of your friends, forget that I'm your friend. Thank you.
A really good thing to eliminate doubt is to research it online. Snopes.com is a good one. And Google... and just really check it out if you're worried about it.
Also, just a little administrivial point here. If you are forwarding something to the mailing lists, please trim the headers. We don't want to see the 20 other people you forwarded it through or where it all came from. Also, we have a policy against jokes and feel-good stories on Cavi Discuss. Not because we're opposed to them specifically, but because there are plenty of other lists for that stuff, which is where they belong. So we thank you all for not sending that stuff onto Cavi Discuss. Nobody has this year. Whilst it might be hilariously funny, We do try to keep our lists on information focus and relevant to the course and stuff like that. So, yeah, it's all good.
We want to install operating system and program updates, as we've just discussed. The benefits are reducing potential hardware and software problems, reduce computer hard drive, and repair costs.
Just a point. I was just going to point out here, has anybody ever had horrible trouble with installing drivers off Windows Update? If you can help it, don't do it, because I've often found that some of the drivers on Windows Update are more trouble than they're worth. Go get them from the manufacturer, because the one from Microsoft was hardware signed, but it's 3 months older than the one that actually works.
Yeah.
Do we have any questions on preventative maintenance? Okay. We're going to go on to the troubleshooting process, and we're going to try and do this fairly quickly. You will get it again next chapter, and the next, and the next, and the next. So we're going to try and get through this. If you have any questions, do feel free to ask, but we're going to try and go rather quickly. All troubleshooting processes are the same. You will develop your own troubleshooting process in time, but here are the general steps that you will need to use when you are troubleshooting.
I was just going to say step zero, calm down and take a deep breath. Okay?
Absolutely. Going into troubleshooting stress.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, the situation may be really, really hard to deal with, but do calm down. Do breathe. There is a solution, and you will find it. It may take you a while. You may have to ask for help, but it should be all right in the end.
And if it's not, then it's not. And there's not really a lot you can do about it. You're either going to work around the problem, or you're going to go to the pub and get very drunk and then find a way to work around the problem once you sober up, to be honest. I've had some pretty shocking things happen to me over the year, huge data loss, all sorts of catastrophe. Sometimes that's just the way it is. No point getting your, as we say over here, no point getting your knickers in a knot over it. You really have to be as calm as you can about these things, because you do not think and act rationally under stress. So try to minimize that stress as much as possible. I am not stressed!
I often help fix a computer for a friend of mine, and she gets very stressed, and it makes my job just about 10 times harder.
Yeah.
Where if she would just simply shut up and let me get on with the job, I could probably do it with minimal fuss and a fraction of the time, you know.
The only problem is you can't say that to your husband, though. That's a difficulty.
You sure can. I don't know how far it'll get you, but you can say it. Yeah. Calm down. Sit down. Go do something else. I'll fix it, honey.
I have actually said that to my wife. She was having an absolute cow about something. I can't remember specifically what it was. And I said, you know what? There's washing you need to put on the line. She's like, excuse me? I said, I'm fixing the problem. It'll be fixed by the time you come back in. Put the washing out. And she stormed out and she put the washing out and she came back in and the problem was fixed and it was all good. And we sat down and had a cup of coffee together. So, yes, yeah, sometimes you can actually, sometimes you do actually have to say that to people, you know. Chill out. Let me do my job. Let me fix the problem. I had a situation where I wanted to fix up somebody's router. I won't name who it was. It was a mutual friend of Elise's and mine. And he's sort of like, oh, I don't know whether I want you to work on that, my boy. What if you break it? And I said, you know what? If I break it, I'll rebook my plane tickets and I will sit here until it's fixed. And he sort of went, well, good enough for me. And it's like, well, what more do you want?
That's about the best you can
absolutely
do, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And it gave them confidence, I would imagine, that, hey, this guy Kerry knows what he's doing. If he says he's going to fix it, he's going to probably fix it. And we won't have to book any plane tickets.
Well, this is true, actually. They've just made a very interesting point, which I'll water down here. That did actually give this person particular confidence. But don't give your users false confidence, because when the you-know-what hits the air distribution device and you don't fix something, you're going to lose all of that confidence you built up, that people built up in you. So do act with as much integrity and honesty and straightforwardness and knowledge as you possibly can, because otherwise you can only fool some of the people some of the time.
Step 0.5, please be prepared For example, bring your hardware and software that will allow you to change out suspect hardware with known good hardware and boot an operating system that is not booting properly. So bring things like your boot disks if you've got them. Bring a portable hard drive with as many utilities as you can. Bring your antivirus type of stuff. Bring your tools, your diagnostic tools if you can. Bring a little netbook if you have one. Pack a Wind in your bag so that you can get on the internet and get drivers if you have to, if you don't have them all on there. Be prepared. Have as much as you can that you'll be able to use with you.
Guy hasn't got back to me. He's been flat out, but his wife's also been sick, so still chasing him up on that. The question for people who didn't see the chat was any talk about how we got speech on Bart PE discs. It wasn't speech, it was Braille, and I'm still waiting to see what he actually did. I have a nasty feeling it had something to do with BRLTTY, but I'll have to check.
Okay, I'm just going to reiterate this one more time, very important. If the customer does not have a backup and you are unable to get the backup, get the customer's permission in writing to proceed. Get the customer's permission in writing to proceed. Very, very, very important. You do not want to be liable for data loss.
Actually, in Australia, if no money changes hands, you're not liable.
Oh, not in America.
Who wants to wants to go do something and not get paid, though?
Well, if you're doing charity work, it's very important.
Yeah,
if you get less than $20 for the job, you're not actually liable because no money changed hands.
Wow, I didn't know that. That is not the case in America, I do not think. So be careful.
Oh, well,
do get
sue,
it
grab it, and run in America, isn't it?
Well, it's a case of sneeze at the wrong time and you're going to get sued.
So much for the Good Samaritan.
Pretty much.
Right. The customer must understand that there is an inherent risk to the data that is stored on the hard drive in many situations.
Actually, this is an interesting point that I usually make each year. Sorry, I'll just quickly make this one. A lot of people don't realize that a hard disk is a very complex and intricate piece of equipment. To give people an idea of what a hard disk does, it's as if a jumbo jet is flying about a third of a millimeter above the ground at Mach 3, counting the blades of grass as it goes. Things can and do go wrong with hard disks. People have this stupid idea that it's this magic box that's going to work forever. It ain't so. So just be aware of that. People put far too much trust in a single hard drive sometimes. And all I can say is it only takes one bounce of your portable hard drive off the desk to render it inoperable permanently.
Unless you get the rubber baby buggies up on it.
Bounce it onto a concrete floor and the rubber won't save you at all. It'll still crash. Sometimes people drop new hard drives and that's the end of them.
Yep, waste of your money.
And they don't replace those ones under warranty.
We've got some important precautions to consider. Verify with the customer about data backups. Yeah, did you make a backup? Do you have access to the backups? When was the last backup? What contents are backed up? Have you tested your backups?
That's very true. Once the head touches the platters, it is a matter of time before it dies.
Are your backups available to us, or are they off-site? What type of media is your backup stored on? These are very important things to ask before the troubleshooting process. Now we're going to go on to the actual troubleshooting process.
Just a point. One of the arguments I often hear from users is backing up is too expensive. I don't have the money to do backups of all of my stuff. What are you, brain dead?
How much is your data worth then, you know?
Well, that's the question I ask them. I say, A, how much is your data worth? And B, oh, looky, your computer's got a DVD burner in it and they're 50 cents a disc. Are you telling me you can't afford 50 cents a disc?
Right.
4.7 gig is a lot of data to fit on one DVD. And you know what? At 50 cents a disc, you can burn two or three copies and put them at different places in the house. Have some off-site backups.
Or off-site, yeah.
Yeah, leave your friends with a set of backup discs. And if you don't want your friends to read the data, encrypt them. But have an off-site backup if your data is really that important to you.
For the cost of one meal at McDonald's, you can have a lot of your data backed up. There you go.
And feel a lot healthier. I haven't looked at Backblaze, but yeah, there are a whole lot of online data storage things. Amazon's got a cloud computing one. I'm not sure which ones are.
Microsoft SkyDrive will give you 25 gigs of free data backup, I've heard.
Yeah, but I bet you have to have a legitimate operating system to use it.
Nope, it's online backup.
Yeah, but does it genuinely validate you, though?
No, it's with a Windows Live Passport account.
I have actually, there is one of our students that has used SkyDrive and they're pretty happy about it, and it works most of the time. Also, and I don't know how accessible some of it is, a lot of your portable hard drives actually come with some backup software on it. The LaCie stuff that I got on one of my portable hard drives was absolutely useless, so that was a...
Sweet!
Ah, cool. That's worth knowing about. So that'll be another URL that'll go in our list of useful links. Gee, this list is getting bigger and bigger, isn't it? If anybody wants to think of categorizations for this list so we can have anchors, that might be useful too. All suggestions to it1@gods.net, of course.
That is unbelievable. Wow.
Not to put too fine a point on it, I assume you would have to know about these things given some of the accidents that sometimes happen the other day. We won't mention what the accident was, but let's just say that none of us are immune to data loss, of course me included, but it happens to the best of us. One slip up, one mistype command, one wrong key press, and you can be pulling a lot of stuff back that you really wish you hadn't... RM in the wrong directory.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can lose a lot of stuff. I actually... I don't know whether anybody's familiar with Linux. Some of you are. I actually did an rm-rf in the /user directory one day. Once I'd stopped swearing about it, I rang my friend up who just happened to have a backup of that particular subfolder and said, "Have you wiped that hard drive yet?" He said, "No." I said, "Right, I need it back over here right now because /usr is gone." Luckily, I still had /bin/cp to put it back.
Good one.
Now, for everybody who doesn't know, rm-rf is a recursive delete command for Linux, just in case you guys don't know what rm-rf
no prompt.
Is.
Once you hit the enter key, it's going. Yeah, but
it's like Deltree, except...
You, doesn't it?
Yeah, it prompts you once, rf doesn't.
Oops.
Oh, I was using rf a lot last night, but at least I wasn't logged in as root.
Okay, I think we're going to save the troubleshooting process for next time, if that's okay with everybody, because I do want to talk about this preventative maintenance sheet that we're going to do if people want to ask all that good stuff, if that's okay with everybody else. I don't think I'm going to quite be able to do it.
We can't get through it in 20 minutes?
You probably could.
I thought we could. It's about three ways of doing it.
Okay. We can do it then.
Well, the other thing I was going to point out is if anybody does have any questions on the on the preventative maintenance sheet that you're going to write up, perhaps you could email your instructors and ask them.
This is true.
And if you want the answer to go to everybody, you can CC the discuss list.
Well, it can always be discussed on the discuss list either way, but yeah.
Is this where we discuss up from the bottom, down from the top, and divide and conquer?
No, that's a different chapter. This is the actual gather data from the customer, verify obvious issues, the big, long troubleshooting process.
Open-ended questions. Go for it.
Yeah, open-ended, closed-ended. Yeah.
Well, hit it, Gracie. Go for it.
All right, let's go. All right, we're going to go through the troubleshooting process. The first step is gather data from the customer. You know what type of information you need to collect already, but you may find it difficult to ask the customer questions to gather specific information. What we need to do is talk about open-ended and close-ended questions. Make sure to use good conversation etiquette. Ask direct questions. Don't ask, what happened on the little thing that you look at? What did you want to ask? What kind of messages were displayed on the monitor? Don't ask if the doohickey's plugged in. Say, could you look behind your computer and see if the RJ45 network cable is plugged in?
Yeah, they might not know what an RJ45 network cable is, but they might know what the blue thing that goes to their router is. So it just depends on how you're going to couch it. Obviously, if you're vision impaired, you're not going to know that the cable's blue or yellow or whatever. But yeah, you certainly can ask those sorts of questions. Now, as far as open-ended and closed-ended questions, a closed-ended question is a question with a yes-no answer.
We're going to get there.
Oh, okay.
We're there yet.
Well, we are now. And if you ask a question like, does your computer work? No. Have you tried rebooting it? Yep. You're not going to get a lot of information out of the customer?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, I wrecked it. So make sure to decide when to use open-ended and closed-ended questions. You may want to start with open-ended questions first, such as, what happened before the error? What were you doing before the error?
No, I think what you probably want to ask is what was happening before the error, because if you ask somebody, what were you doing before the error, they can actually sometimes feel as though you're blaming them.
It's quite
and maybe it is their... you've got to be a bit careful because you're accused. I mean, you can say, what was happening before the error, or what was going on the computer, but don't sort of use things like, what were you doing before the error, or what the hell were you doing? That doesn't make people feel very confident, and it can
often scare
them.
You might feel like saying that.
Yeah.
No, I didn't mean it that way. I just said, what work were you doing before the error? What?
I know. I see Grace's point of view. I agree with Grace, but I know people get accused of.
Not what did you do to cause the error? What were you doing before the error?
No, but people do take it the wrong way, and whilst what you have to say with the best of intentions, people are going to take it the wrong way because remember, it's your fault the computer's broken and your network's not working. Not their fault. It's your fault. You're the network person.
No. But it wasn't blaming anybody. It's just what was going on, you know?
Generally, just be careful how you phrase it because people are often under a lot of stress when something is broken and they will take something as an accusation even if you don't mean it. And you'd rather not be explaining that you don't mean it that way. You'd rather be getting on with the next six questions you've got. That was all I was saying. You know, just be very careful how you word things because there are people who will be very sensitive and will assume that it's their fault if you ask them, you know, what were you doing? It's best to say something like, so what was happening on the computer before it crashed? Or what were you working on before the computer crashed? This is user-provided data.
Once you've gotten your open-ended question and listened to what they have to you is going on, you might want to ask closed-ended questions like...
Depends on the case-by-case basis. You really have to decide, because he's asking how do you decide what's more important, system-gathered data or user-gathered data. You probably want to get user data before you get system-gathered data.
You need to know what exactly has gone wrong from the customer's point of view, because that can give you a lot of clues as to which system data you want to take.
It also depends if you're working on-site.
I'm a doctor by training.
Yep,
and,
go ahead, Jackie.
One of the things that my professors always used to tell me is if you're surprised by what you find on the physical exam, you didn't take a good history. The history is absolutely like the critical phase of any kind of troubleshooting/diagnostic process. I am here to tell you it really is.
Yeah, I agree with you on the computer. You do want to talk and really listen to the customer so that you'll get lots of clues. You'll get lots and lots of clues for when you do check out the computer.
It also depends depends on whether you're working on-site or off-site as to how much system-gathered data you can actually get out of them. If you're working on-site...
Of course not.
No, they won't download that, but at least you've got to talk to the user first because the user has to be happy with the fact that you've extracted as much information as you can from them. I agree that you're not always going to get the solution off the user, but you are going to get a lot of a lot of information off the user.
That's why police take eyewitness reports, not only just the data, the DNA, and the clues around the area. The eyewitnesses might not be perfect.
I would have thought that experience would teach you this process.
It does, but you'd be surprised how many technicians go around and just try random things until it works. There are certainly people in this building that often use that approach to troubleshooting, and it's not cool.
You know, I was always taught that if you listen to the patient 95% of the time, you'll be able to figure out pretty much, especially if it's a fairly common thing. Now, obviously, if we're chasing zebras, that's another story. But in many cases, you can figure out what's going on just by a good history.
Absolutely. It's very important to talk to them. They might not give you all of the information you need, but they can give you some good clues.
It also makes them feel involved with the troubleshooting process, and they feel as though they're getting somewhere. And when it actually comes down to you collecting the system-gathered data, you've then got them on side so that they'll leave you alone, and in a lot of good cases make you a beverage of your choice if they're those sort of users.
Go ahead, Jenny. There's nothing worse than when a technician is sitting there fixing your computer, never ever says a word to you, and you think, well, what the hell's going on in there? And he just sits there and never says anything. I've got a son who does that.
My mom actually got her computer fixed a while ago, and he just sat there. Where's the computer? Sat down, went to work. Not a word.
I can tell you from experience...
That makes people feel kind of uneasy.
It does. Whether you're fixing a computer or building a website, or whatever you're doing with your customer, the more you include them in the process, the better they'll feel. So when something does go wrong that you are having trouble fixing, they'll actually still make you that cup of tea and like you.
Yeah.
It makes them feel valued, and that's important.
It does. Makes them feel valued, and it's called rapport building. You build a rapport with a customer, and if you get good at it, almost the whole world can almost destroy itself and you won't get the blame.
And I think that's particularly important if you're going into people's homes, maybe even more so than in an organisation, you know, where people are just going to let you get on with it.
Yeah, you're going into these people's personal space. You want to make sure they feel comfortable with you.
And if you are going, even if you are on a corporate level, it does help to build the rapport with the company, because otherwise how are you ever going to ask that cute girl in accounts out to lunch if you don't build a rapport?
Absolutely.
Well, I don't think I'm going to ask the cute girl in accounting out to lunch, no.
Well, the cute guy then, Jackie.
Well, I don't know. I mean, yeah. Maybe you just want to get to know this cute girl in accounting. The fact that she's cute might be just incidental. It just might be you just might need help with your next tax return. I don't know. It's just an example. But the cute employee out to lunch, or even make some friends with people. Because one of the things I find very difficult, without getting into a big personal expose, is it's very difficult to make friends if you don't build rapport with people. And that's something that a lot of us struggle with as we grow up, especially as vision impaired people, is actually breaking this ice. And we'll fair enough.
Right on.
Where's your sense of adventure, Jackie?
Well, marriage tends to dampen that.
I guess so.
Here.
Yeah, look, the other thing is, if you build a rapport with people, it can often make working with them infinitely easier. And it's especially critical to build a rapport people in the adaptive technology industry, because
everybody knows everybody.
Everybody knows everybody, and in my not so humbled opinion, in general terms, the blind lot are the hardest bunch to work with, because they're all rather cranky and uppity. And if you can't build a rapport with them, it makes your job fixing their technology a lot harder. And that certainly is a challenge working in the adaptive tech field. You've got to have a thick skin, flameproof underwear, and a lot of patience.
Can I just relate a story? There's a technology company here, which I will not name, in Australia, Adaptive Technology. My husband has been trying to get information out of them to purchase a product. So he went to the big bosses, and now he has contacted a rival company, and this morning has ordered what he wants, and it's on the way.
Well, if you can't give them information, that's what they're going to get, you know? You really gotta you gotta serve your customers, and they'll serve you back. And build rapport, and be nice to them, and get them the information promptly, and answer their questions.
And you know, like I had a situation. I had a situation once where this lady thought that she was the was the cause of a virus infection and everything else. She thought that she had brought it to work or whatever, and she was very distraught. And she was pregnant, and she was starting to you know, like, have some premature contractions and stuff like that. I was actually able to prove just the opposite, that the infection had started at her work, and she brought it home to her own computer, and that she had not infected the work computer. And it was like the contraction stopped, and she went ahead and went full term. But I was really pretty concerned about the situation.
Could be the difference between whether you kept your job or not.
Yeah, that's huge.
I think the other thing that's worth mentioning, and I think Leon's about to point out that Computer Alliance has helped her a lot over the years, and they're very helpful to her, and that's a wonderful thing to have happen, and an excellent thing to have happen. I'm just going to make this point once. Just because you're blind and just because you don't have a lot of money does not mean that the world owes you free technical support. So whilst you may be lucky enough to come across some very gifted and talented people that will help you for nothing, two things you can do. A, don't expect everything for free, and B, do say thank you. And especially give people a box of Lindt chocolates. In Jenny's case, I love fixing her computer problems because I get a box of Lindt chocolates. It only costs her a few dollars, but it means that the next time she has a computer problem, she will actually get hers fixed, even if she doesn't give me the box of Lindt chocolates, because I remember from last time. Treat people as you wish to be treated. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That's in Matthew somewhere. I can't remember where it is. Jesus said it of all people. And it's true. Treat people with a bit of respect, and don't expect the world to give you everything for nothing. It doesn't work that way.
I think it's also an Exodus.
Is it? I didn't think so.
Ten Commandments.
No.
No, because that's actually the 11th commandment that Jesus added in after the 10.
Not quite. But I won't argue that.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Let's not get into a theology debate in lecture, but that's what they'd like us to think in the church I went to, that it was the 11th commandment that you added in, but it didn't actually say that that's what it was. So there you go.
Carrie, the 11th commandment is CYA.
Yes, that is that's definitely a commandment in technology.
Yes. I think the other thing is, because nothing is free, and you do have to pay for things, I'll put my hand up for this. If you're going to ask somebody a question about their program, as a matter of fact, I lobbed a question at Christopher about his program Quitter, which is a great bit of gear. We talked about it last week. But the fact is, I donated first, and that probably made him happier to answer my question than if I hadn't donated. And that doesn't mean I won't donate again, because I probably will. But if you donate or you pay somebody for a program or something, asking somebody for free tech support on a piece of shareware you haven't registered is a pretty crummy thing to do. They're trying to feed their family as well. So just keep in mind that everybody's time is valuable, and how would you feel if nobody paid you for the assistance you put in?
I know how it feels.
And everybody has to feel appreciated. That's important as well.
For instance, I will pay Jackie for sure the shipping and handling charges of this KVM switch she speaks of. I just need to know how much and when it's going to need to get there.
Let's keep that off lecture if we can. You guys can talk about that amongst yourselves. Whilst we encourage free enterprise in the CAVI community, we'll try and keep that at a lecture, and you guys can work that out between yourselves.
Oh yeah, you can edit that part of it out of the lecture, I'm sure.
Certainly will.
Okay, it is almost 11 o'clock, so we should probably wind this up. We will get to the rest of the troubleshooting processes next week. Does anyone have any questions about anything we've covered today?
Also, yeah, Grace was right, but it was good to actually get halfway through this so that there'd be less to do next week. Is everybody enjoying the course? Are we all enjoying ourselves here and stuff? I know it goes a bit slow for some of you. You'd all rip through and do the exams in 2 weeks, and if you can do that, knock yourself out. But is everybody enjoying themselves so far? Everybody having fun?
Absolutely. Especially the behind-the-scenes stuff.
Yeah, that is fun.
I can say I'm loving it. A little stressful at times, but I'm loving it nonetheless.
I'm hoping that maybe some of those who have less experience can learn from those of us who have a little bit more experience.
Yeah, it's a good time to learn from those who do have a lot of experience, love technology, and are blind, and it's great.
It's not just the actual course material that you can get a benefit from. It's just learning all those other neat little things that just get said in the conversation. Oh, I didn't know that. That's cool.
Well, the reason that I'm doing these lectures again is because I want to learn more from you guys, and that's precisely why I'm here, and I'm doing that.
Excellent, and it's great to have you back.
Absolutely.
What is a technology alliance?
Technology alliance. Oh, they're a computer shop.
Oh, it's a mob that Leon's using, isn't it?
Computer alliance.
Yeah, Computer Alliance. They're a computer shop in Brisbane that have helped her out over the years with a lot of her computer problems.
Okay, got it.
Because sometimes, and I'll be quite upfront with this, if you don't have a lot of money and you have quite a lot of computer problems, it can sometimes be difficult to find people to help you with those computer problems. It's a bit like moving house. You really find out who your friends are pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really enjoying it. I'm just sorry to say I didn't realize how much I didn't know.
Oh, that's all right.
But that's what it's for. It's good to learn and review, and then you do know it. And you get to pass it on to other people.
Wasn't there some proverb that the man who knows that he's knows nothing knows something, therefore he is on the first step to knowledge? I can't remember, something like that. But honestly, we don't all know it all. Some of us get things thrown at us because we look like we know it all. But we all don't know it all, and we can all learn from each other, and you'd be surprised at the depth of knowledge that is out there in the community.
Very true.
Okay.
Well done again, Grace, even with all the interruptions.
Oh, that's fine, as long as people... it's okay if we split things over a couple modules. I don't care how slow or fast we take it. We're all here for a while, and I think it's great that we're all sharing all the information we have. Yep, we're just going to restart the troubleshooting process again and review it.
Okay.
It says that we don't want to spread too many across too many weeks. We do have to do that from time to time, but if we did it every week, we won't get through, unfortunately.
Still, it's better to have the discussion than have a situation where we get no student interaction at all. It's a lot harder to lecture to non-interactive students. Yeah.
Is Joe on channel?
He is not on channel.
I've got some questions. I'll talk to him another time then.
I don't think I've ever seen him on channel.
He wants to come, but he hasn't gotten around
no,
to it yet.
No, I think
yet.
You're right, Carrie. I don't think I've seen him. We get lots of email from him, which is good.
Yeah. Oh, he's doing real well. I'll talk to you about that. I'll call you up about that a little later, and mm-hmm. I just had a question for you, but we'll be good about that. I'll talk to you in just a little.
Good night, mate.
Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Just a reminder that I'm sorry about the delay. Grace has turned up and I've been otherwise occupied, but all of the lectures from last week and stuff went up onto the server, so the server is up to date, except for yesterday's discovery lecture and today's lecture, which will go up in about 20 to 30 minutes, just so people know. So the material is up on the website for download. Yeah, and if I honestly do forget something, ping me or DM me or something, because I do forget, and if you remind me, I'll make it happen.
I'll catch you folks later.
All right, have fun, Liam.
Have a good one, all.
Bye, guys.
Okay, folks, talk to you later. Enjoy.